Hello and welcome to episode 92 of the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. I am Patrick Macias, the author of the new book, Mondo Tokyo, Dispatches from a Secret Japan.
And I'm Matt Ault, the author of Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World, which isn't new, which means all of you should have a copy, right? Right? Right?
And have a copy of my book? Several copies of my books?
Too? Yes. Books. So is it true, Patrick, that you wrote 100 books in Hollywood and never lost a dime?
Oh my God. Are you talking about Roger Corman?
I am. I can't believe it.
The king of the B movies, Matt, he's gone. 98 years old. Can you believe it?
At first blush, somebody like Roger Corman, who is the B movie master of Hollywood, wouldn't seem to have much in common with our humble little podcast. But actually, there were quite a few crossovers between Roger Corman and Japan, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, he gets credit for like launching the careers of like Jack Nicholson and Francis Ford Coppola and James Cameron,
Scorsese, Jonathan Demme. It's fun to note, though, that none of those people stuck around.
Right.
As soon as they could, they ran away screaming and looked back fondly on the man with some affection. But yeah, Roger Corman, king of the bees, much loved. I think he made the world a better place by making all of these fast, cheap, out-of-control movies. Yeah, as far as Japan goes, he did dabble in anime. He did dabble in Japanese live-action movies from time to time.
Most famously, or at least the first time I was aware of it, was, I believe, Warriors of the Wind, the Baudelaireization, am I pronouncing this right, of Nausicaa, of Miyazaki's Nausicaa. It's kind of unthinkable that somebody would take a Ghibli, well, it wasn't a Ghibli movie at that point, that was kind of pre-Ghibli, that would take a Miyazaki movie and like recut it and like do all sorts of things to it to make it quote unquote more palatable to Western audiences. But it was the 80s. Anime was not as respected of a medium, of an art form as it is today. And did you actually see that?
The first time I saw Nausicaa was as Warriors of the Wind on New World Home Video. You know, much hated Roger Corman is by certain anime fans because, I mean, the perception is he tore out like large chunks of Warriors of the Wind, or he tore out large chunks of the Galaxy Express movie and released those in America. But the thing is, Matt, he was only the distributor.
Right.
He was only the distributor. He didn't necessarily get in there with the scissors and cut things himself. But there's definitely this kind of like perception of like the Roger Corman cut. Roger Corman, you know, destroyed.
It's just like the Richard Donner cut. It's the Roger Corman cut of, you know, it's my impression that like it wasn't like he was out scouring the markets for like anime or Japanese films. Like these things kind of came to him because if you needed money in Hollywood to distribute something or you needed a distributor, his was a kind of open door. Is that perception correct?
I think so. But in some cases, he would sort of put together the Americanization. A big one for me back in the day was Godzilla 1985.
Oh, is that him?
That was Roger Corman's New World Pictures, baby. They got Raymond Burr back. They filmed a bunch of new scenes. They re-edited the crap out of it, dubbed it in English, and did like kind of a sloppy job. But there it was.
Troops, aircraft, rockets. They were all used before. All they'll do is confuse and antagonize him further. He's looking for something, searching. If only we could figure out what it is before it's too late.
That's Raymond Burr, of course, and he and Godzilla are the only two survivors from the original 1956 movie, which became a camp classic because it was so bad. Well, this movie may or may not become a classic, but it's equally bad. And I think they shot all of Raymond Burr's scenes on the same day. He just stands there and he has one line after another. You'll never stop Godzilla that way. That will never stop Godzilla. It will take more than that to stop Godzilla. I think they just set him down, did all of those lines, and they throw in a Raymond Burr scene every 5 minutes. It's typical of this movie. I give Godzilla 1985 one star. And I'm Roger Ebert.
And also, he did something similar with Submersion of Japan, Nihon Chimbotsu, where they cut the crap out of the original, put Lorne Greene in there, and renamed it Tidal Wave, turned schlock into like real schlock, downgraded it.
But wait a second. Didn't they also, I don't know if it was New World, but I'm pretty sure it was Corman, Shogun Assassin. Did he not do the Baby Card Assassin movie release in America?
Oh, I can tell you about Shogun Assassin, Matt, because I wrote the complete oral history of the making of Shogun Assassin, wherein two enterprising indie filmmakers did this cut themselves. They acquired the rights. They dubbed the film. They did it as an independent production and then sold it to New World Pictures. Okay? And the director, Robert Houston, says to me,
"We had expectations of making a profit, but then again, this is the film business, so we didn't see a dime beyond our advance from New World. Now, 5 years later, Roger Corman publishes a book called How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime, and Chapter 6 begins, and then I found a little gold mine called Shogun Assassin. So, it was a gold mine for Corman, but it was a no profit, no nothing for us.
Oh man, brutal, brutal. But you know, you swim with the sharks, you know, you get eaten like the fishes. I'm mixing my metaphors or something, but you get the point. I don't think anybody wanted to be at the non-leverage having side of a negotiation with Roger Corman. I mean, he did make 100 movies in Hollywood and never lost a dime. Although it's like now that Japanese pop culture is quote unquote cool, I don't think it necessarily trickles down to these, like, for lack of a better word, bottom feeding distributors and stuff like it would have back in the 70s, 80s, and probably early 90s. My big question, Patrick, is why? Why there is no Bandai Soul of Chogokin from Battle Beyond the Stars? Why? Why? Ooh, why?
That would be a nice one. God, I love that movie. There's so many good Roger Corman movies that he like distributed or had a hand in production or greenlit. And that's one from Battle Beyond the Stars. Wowie zowie. But also he did do some other animated films. He released Fantastic Planet, that super surreal French animated movie that's a must watch. If you've never seen Fantastic Planet, drop whatever you're doing and watch it now. And I think your favorite movie, Dirty Duck, Matt.
Nothing to do with Fritz the Cat, Patrick. It's about a duck and a dirty one at that.
Dirty Duck has a message for the world.
It was a follow-up to Fritz the Cat, right? It's rated X. X for ecstasy, correct? Which I think everybody was probably on when they were making it.
It's not Ralph Bakshi, though. It's not Bakshi.
No. It's like Mouth Pakshi, I believe. No, it's somebody totally different. I actually didn't even know about this film until quite recently. It was not on my radar. I mean, Fritz the Cat was enough. That was like my X-rated animation knowledge, like there's a huge gap between Fritz the Cat and like Ninja Scroll. Dirty Duck does fill in, it's the missing link, as it were. It's a bit of a trip, as I recall. Can you tell us what the story was in that?
Oh, on Dirty Duck? I'm not entirely sure. It was not Japanese animated, Matt. And as you know, I only watch Japanese animation, specifically if like 45 minutes to like an hour has been cut out of the original version of it, like with the Galaxy Express movie.
So wait, Nausicaa gets cut, but Dirty Duck does not get cut? What's going on, man?
Fantastic Planet, also no cuts, Matt. It must have been something in the Constitution that MacArthur like.
Well,
said,
this is, you know. But you know, this actually literally must be why that there's that famous moment where Disney acquires the rights to the Ghibli stuff in the 90s, but is too terrified to release it because like they still think like cartoons are for kids. And so Miramax, you know, Harvey Weinstein's company releases it. And Suzuki, the CEO of Ghibli, and Miyazaki send him a samurai sword with a note saying no cuts. Very famous moment, and obviously a kind of homage slash nod. I mean, I'm sure working with Miramax, if you're, you know, any kind of unknown quantity, must be about as pleasurable as working with Corman. But I think that Nausicaa was definitely on their minds when they sent that thinly veiled threat to Miramax.
How do you think Miyazaki felt when he found out that Dirty Duck, no cuts, Nausicaa, minus 20 minutes?
Did Ghibli acquire Dirty Duck for release in Japan? I sure hope so. This is literally the most Dirty Duck has gotten talked about in easily 40 years. So if the director, producer, animators are out there, please send us, you know, some PR money, some, you know, royalty checks, whatever, because we've probably sold at least one extra copy of your film.
He is more Daffy than Donald and more expensive than
Is that literally the tagline?
The taglines are madder than Daffy, dumber than Donald, more existential than Howard the Duck. And believe me, Matt, this duck knows how to party.
Well, you know, it's true. There is a duck trilogy out there. Donald, Daffy.
Dirty.
And when I first heard the title, I thought it was going to be more like Dirty Harry. You know, like he's a violent duck, kind of like a Takeshi Kitano film.
He takes on the crimes the other ducks aren't willing to handle.
Speaking of anime, doesn't this segue neatly into our feel-good segment of the episode?
Ooh, nicely. Yes, it says here, the next headline, century-old anime discovered in Japan.
An anime created about a century ago is shining new light on the industry after it was recently discovered here in Japan. An expert says only a few films from that era exist today, so the newly found work will greatly help in understanding anime production from that time. The film depicts a child enjoying a meal using a knife and fork. It also shows another child eating something out of a bag. The silent film was produced around 1923 and was discovered from the belongings of a late avid cinema fan. The film is said to have been produced by a company that sold toothbrushes and other daily necessities.
Good, awesome. Look, and just let's, I want to put aside the discussion of the content and merit and all of that of this film, this short film, for a second. It's not anime. It's not anime.
What?
And no, it's not, because anime is, you know, anime is a word that was coined by Osamu Tezuka, the quote unquote god of manga, who created Astro Boy, Blackjack, blah, blah, blah. Who, you know him well if you've been listening to us for any length of time. He coined that term in 1963 to describe Astro Boy. And what he was more specifically describing was domestically produced television length, you know, 20 minutes, whatever it was, with commercials, animation in Japan. That's what it was.
But it says on my Netflix queue, Matt, that Castlevania is anime.
Well, now the term has been expanded quite broadly, but if we're going to be very, you know, if we're going to hew to the historical definitions, anything before Astro Boy, even if it was animated in Japan, is Japanese animation. Anime is like television oriented, you know, feature, not feature. What do you call it? Episode length? Episodic?
A mistake? Anime was a mistake?
Anime was a mistake, Patrick. Well, you know, famously, Miyazaki, who didn't send a samurai sword to Osamu Tezuka, though he probably wanted to, wrote a really, really scathing obituary of Tezuka after Tezuka's death in 1989, saying he basically cursed the industry by working too cheaply. But this is another story.
Wait, does this come from the guy who makes like cup noodle instant ramen for his staff while they're making his movie?
He famously, you know, renovated his offices to make them very comfortable for the animators. Like the women's bathroom at the offices is like five times the size of the men's room. There's actually a really interesting memoir written by a woman who, she used to run a cafe in Ogikubo, or Nishi Ogikubo, and she was an animation checker at Ghibli. Like she actually had, even above Miyazaki, had like sign off authority on whether the animated like the cells that she was looking at like match the reference art and stuff like that. And even if Miyazaki had drawn it and it was off model, she'd be like, no, off model. She wrote a really interesting memoir that unfortunately has not been translated into English, but she wrote extensively about how, you know, nicely, I mean, I don't think it was nice to be working there, but like he treated the staff pretty well anyway. Well, we are off topic, Patrick, because we're talking about anime, quote unquote, or not, from a century ago.
Yeah, apparently a century ago, there were a lot of anime that were kind of based around a legend about an overfiend who lived in a wicked city. So this film was kind of unique because it was about brushing your teeth. Dental health? Is that like mental health?
Is it a ninja scroll? It's a educational short about brushing your teeth, and it seems to have been made by, I'm sure the AI voice told us, I wasn't listening because I tune out whenever I hear the word AI. It was like, I think produced by like a toothpaste company or something like that. But the guy who animated it, Kitayama Seitaro, is actually a real pioneer in Japanese animated history at that like roaring 20s, like late teens, roaring 1920s time frame, when Japan was getting this huge, it was getting its first taste of animation in the form of like reels of Disney and Fleischer Brothers stuff was coming in, and that inspired Japanese artists to try making their own. And there's actually like detailed descriptions of how Kitayama worked from old Japanese magazines and stuff. And I'm looking at Jonathan Clements' Anime, A History here. He actually dedicates quite a few pages to Kitayama. Not this particular animated segment, of course, because it was just discovered, but he had built this entire animation studio in Nikatsu, which I believe you've heard of. Do you know? Do you know Nikatsu?
Yeah, Nikatsu Studios. This must have been like a long time before they did the whole Nikatsu Roman porno thing, like in the late.
It was indeed a couple decades before Roman porno came out. This is actually even a couple decades before, less actually, 1918. In 1918, he had this whole like kind of studio set up where they'd like put the paper on the floor, and they had like a camera sitting on like this contraption that looked, it was kind of like bunk beds where you'd put the thing to be photographed on the bottom shelf and you had the camera on the top. He filmed this way until the earthquake of 1923, which closed down Nikatsu Studios. It's like, I mean, this guy was a real, real pioneer of animation. It's really cool they found this cartoon. cartoon. It's a little bit rough and tumble by even contemporary standards. Like if you compare it to like Fleischer Brothers stuff or, you know, Disney stuff of the era, it's a little rough, but it's cool. It's very cool.
It looks a little older than like 1923. It has like kind of a paper cutout kind of feel, whereas people were doing, you know, what would become kind of like hand-drawn, more fluid character animation.
Yeah, there's a lot of like repeated, like really simple. I mean, animation is full of kind of like repeated, you know, kind of simple things going on.
So is podcasting.
Well, you know, never, Patrick. We never repeat ourselves. I wouldn't even. I'm actually flipping through the book right now, looking for other, you know, stuff about him. There's quite a bit. This is actually quite a good book. A new version of it came out, Anime History. It does a lot to explain about this huge history of animation that exists before Astro Boy. You know, most people, when they talk about anime history, they just think about the kind of character stuff, the manga-based stuff.
There was Alakazam the Great, and then there was Astro Boy.
Exactly. But, you know, anime, again, if you're being really, really strict, it's only for post-Astro Boy television animation. Of course, it's gotten a lot bigger. We're using it for a lot of things, like apparently things that weren't even made in Japan. You know, now it's being used for that if you're on Netflix.
What about these like CGI monstrosities that are just meant to keep IP alive as like contractual obligations? Is that what this guy had in mind?
Are you referring to that Dunbine short that just came out for no apparent reason that I'm actually think is quite cool? You know what I'm talking about,
right? We
talked
about that a little bit. I mean, I'm sure we at least have three or four people who know what Dunbine is listening to our show.
So Dunbine was a 1980, was it four or five? We look on Wikipedia. We're not. What am I? Your Wikipedia? It's a Sunrise post-Gundam, quote-unquote, real robot anime, though it's set in this sort of fantasy swords and sorcery world where this young buck from Tokyo falls through a rip in the space-time continuum and winds up in this place called Bison Well, which is like this, you know, kingdom, like Lord of the Ringsy kind of thing where the kingdoms are fighting using these giant bug robot things called Aura Battlers, of which Dunbine is the titular Aura Battler. I love the designs. The animation never came to the States. To get to the point why we're talking about this now, I'm not exactly sure why, but Sunrise released like a 7 or 8 minute long CG-ified kind of like update of the theme song and a kind of digest of the show really quickly. And it's cool. I mean, it's cool seeing these like robot designs and the characters. It's kind of like hybrid CG, I think. I mean, I don't think there's any cells used or anything. It doesn't, it's like toon shaded. It doesn't look cheap. It looks good. And it has that Galactica 80 moment. The coolest thing about Dunbine is it's like most of it is set in this like fantasy world, but then like the rip in the space-time continuum happens again. And all of the orb battlers come to fight in over the skies of Tokyo, which is of course what everybody wanted from the very beginning. That's in the clip too. You can see this on YouTube. If you've never seen Dunbine, it's a great kind of introduction to it. This is anime, Patrick. It's anime.
I mean, I think some people point to it as one of the pioneering works in the isekai genre.
Yes.
The kind of like fantasy world, like loser protagonist gets sucked into a fantasy world. All these shows that have been like hitting us upside the head for the last, gosh, almost 20 years now. There's a lot of isekai out there, but Dunbine was one of the first.
You know, I first learned about Dunbine because when I was a kid growing up, like there these, you could find some of the toys from it in the States. Like they were sold, I think there were bootlegs, I don't know, of like Clover. Clover was the sponsor of the series. Clover is the same company who famously sponsored Gundam and then bowed out the minute that they didn't have good ratings and then like completely lost out when Bandai got the plastic model rights to it. And that actually kind of happened again. I think Bandai released all the plastic models from Dunbine and Clover and Tomy and a couple other companies did the toys.
Do you have any favorite characters like Silky Mao or like Shot Weapon or Rabadan Zaraman?
No, my favorite character is the Aura Battler Bill Bine, who sounds like some dude from like accounting downstairs. Mr. Bine? Mr. Bill Bine? That's like the superpowered Dunbine. Anyway, he's in that little clip too, Bill Bine. You can see him.
It seems like they're powering up for some sort of experiment in terror revolving around like maybe computer assisted animation techniques and old IP. I mean, what else is in the hopper? There's potentially we could see one of these done for Ideon or Zabungle or any of these other kind of like Sunrise Real Robot shows.
I wonder how much of this is driven by the success of the Yamato CG reboots.
Success.
22, 33. They all have those like Evangelion style names. It's like it's strings of numbers, which I can't even fathom anymore.
But I'm going to get on my soapbox and complain because they use like the original titles. It's like Be Forever Yamato. Andromeda 2838 there. So whenever I'm looking on Mercury, or like whenever I'm at Mandarake looking for Be Forever Yamato stuff from like 1980, it's all junked up now with all this remake crap. I hate it.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I'm not against those remakes or anything. We've talked about this before on previous episodes. I have in my cohort of friends, I have some serious diehard fans of those. And you know, more power to you. I don't judge. I don't kink shame.
But come up with your own shit is kind of something you might want to think about if you're a creative person.
Yeah. I'm looking at this. I'm looking at the lists of like Dunbine was preceded by Zabungle and Dugram, and anteceded, is that the word I'm looking for? Almost exactly the same time. Votoms was airing around the same time. Then Vifam, Elgame, Giant Gorg. If you can image all of these characters in your mind as I am saying them, you are probably kind of old. Or a subscriber to Toybox DX.
What about the Crest superheroes fighting the cavity creeps with their magic toothbrushes?
This has nothing to do with Dunbine. It just has to do with brushing teeth. And there is no toothbrushing sequence in Dunbine because they don't have teeth, Patrick.
They didn't have a sponsor that would pay the bills.
Clover wanted kids to have cavities so they could sell more candy to them or something. I don't know. This is on this conspiracy theory. Speaking of crime and conspiracy, what's next?
Speaking of sponsors, crimes, and conspiracy, Matt, I have some terrible news for you, Matt. This might be the worst news I've ever had to report on this podcast. Okay. Shakey's in Shinjuku closes down.
Wait, what? What?
Shakey's Pizza in Tokyo's Shinjuku district closed for business after a 40-year tenancy. Once Tiffany's took over next to the basement floor entrance, Shakey's lost its prominent street front signage. A message on the Shakey's website read, "Due to various circumstances, we have decided to close our doors for the last time on Monday, May 6th, 2024. After having enjoyed your exceptional patronage since our opening in 1984, we would like to express our sincere gratitude for your patronage over the years."
Matt, is this why Joe Biden said Japan is xenophobic? Why would they close down a Shakey's in Tokyo? What's going on out there?
They're driving us out, Pat. They're driving our pizza technology out. It's the protectionist Japanese market. There still are, if I am not mistaken. So they closed down in Shinjuku. And I don't think I ever went to that one. Where was it exactly?
It was on Shinjuku Dori. Here's the story, man. The first time I ever came to Japan, I got lost in Shinjuku by myself. And I was starving like Marvin. And I looked up to the heavens. And there in front of me was the Shakey's sign, Matt. The familiar sight from my childhood in Sacramento, California. The birthplace of Shakey's, as I like to remind everyone, 38 times a day. And I went inside and had the pizza buffet, and it was fabulous. And that's where I created this sort of parent-child bond with Shakey's in Japan that I still hold on to today, which is why I'm particularly outraged by this news.
Is that your origin story? Is that like, you know, some people are bitten by radioactive spiders. You just consumed enough factory cheese, government cheese, to block you up for months on end. Yes, it is enough to create a love story. Good news. There are still multiple other Shakey's locations.
How is that good? Now they're like living in Sniper's Alley on the endangered species list, Matt. If they can take one Shakey's out of commission, they can take the other ones.
Shibuya is still there. Ikebukuro is still there.
Kichijoji.
And I think there's one in Seiseki Sakuragaoka, which is a mouthful of a place, but that's out down the Keio line. So they live. And there's like a couple others scattered around the country, like one in Fukuoka. There's one on the Space 1999 Moon Base Alpha, I believe, on the dark side of the moon. And I think there's one deep beneath the Earth's crust.
The Earth's pizza crust, the deep dish crust, or is that the
Man, I'm
the
getting
flat
hungry
crust?
Now. Man, I'm getting hungry for some crust.
Well, I guess the story is that like a Tiffany's high-end luxury jewelry store opened up next to Shakey's or in the same building, and like Shakey's kind of took a low profile. I mean, this was breakfast at Tiffany's, wasn't it? Pretty much was like the pizza buffet.
I would imagine, I'm just going to lay this down here, that in a fist fight between Shakey's and Tiffany's, that you would think Shakey's would have the street smarts and also those kind of wheeled pizza, you know, weapons.
Oh, the pizza cutters? Yeah.
To defeat Tiffany's in a one-on-one battle. But apparently they lost out on this one. Tiffany's got the drop on them. I'm never shopping at Tiffany's again unless they release a Shakey's memorial. Maybe they can do like a diamond ring encrusted with little pepperoni rubies.
We got to chain ourselves to the door at the one at Kichijoji, Matt. I swear to God, they're coming for it next.
This is a big thing. Shinjuku used to be, and especially around the time that Shakey's came to Japan, which is in the 70s, when Japan, and Shakey's was part of this whole wave of Western fast food and convenience stores and things. The Japanese government allowed foreign companies to invest directly in companies in Japan. Well, this is when McDonald's came and, like, you know, a bunch of other companies came, Shakey's did. And Shinjuku was where you put your flagship store. And it extended to other, you know, kinds of companies as well. Sanrio had its flagship store there. Many others, you know, losing your Shinjuku store, man. It's a blow. It's a blow softened only by the velvety smoothness of the cheese that Shakey's uses on those smorgasbord all-you-can-eat pizza buffets.
I mean, if I had known, I would have got on my straw hat and my banjo and ran down there for like one more lunch buffet, but...
Question, was it actually a straw hat? Because mine, they were always styrofoam in the shape of straw. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, but those are the ones they give the kids, Matt. The real deal Sacramento Shakey's guys like me, we get the straw hats. We're the straw hat pirates, okay?
Damn. Yeah, you're the original One Piece. Is this where One Piece got its one piece of Shakey's pizza? Is that what the actual prize they're all searching for is? I hope so.
Losing a Shakey's hurt me personally. It kind of devastated me for a while. This next one might do a similar trick for some listeners out there. Matt, Lost in Translation Hotel closed for renovations.
Tourists hoping to stay at the Park Hyatt Tokyo will have to find another place to stay if they're planning to travel to Japan anytime soon, as the entire hotel is currently closed. Originally opened in 1994 and made Hollywood famous through serving as the primary setting for the 2003 movie Lost in Translation, the Park Hyatt Tokyo was closed for renovations with plans to reopen in October 2025.
Did you actually know this place was called the Lost in Translation Hotel?
Yeah, that's its official name. It's not called the Grand Park Hyatt. It's called the Lost in Translation Hotel.
Sometimes I just walk around and just like tap people on the shoulder and go, hey, do you know where the Lost in Translation Hotel is here in Japan?
Is it true that you can only use valet parking if you show up in a Kigurumi suit and a Super Mario Kart? Is that true? Yes, it is a Emerald City style triple stacked building in...
It's Nishi Shinjuku. So yeah, that's West Side. It's a West Side story.
And it's closing down for a year and a half. I'm kind of shocked. It must be, you know, obviously this plans have been in the works for a while. They're renovating it. It's not like it's actually closing down. And it's funny because it wasn't like, I've been in there fairly recently. Andy and I went to the bar a couple of months back. And Lord, you will leave a little bit lighter in the wallet when you do that. It didn't look bad to me. It didn't look dated or anything. But I guess when you're a super high-end hotel, you have to kind of keep pace with the times. It must be hurting them, though, to close down right now when like billions of tourists are coming into Japan, like pouring in over the borders, you know, into xenophobic Japan, you know, the country that hates apparently foreign people and is like, there's more Americans here now than in America, I believe.
When they come here, they're all waving like Blu-ray and DVD copies of Lost in Translation. And I want to say to those people, you know, there are better movies to watch like Star Trek, the motion picture, or like Xanadu.
Or Roger Corman's Warriors of the Wind. Well, it's funny because that movie actually, and people get so mad when I say this, like Japanese people, like especially the people working on the film said that they thought it was kind, quote unquote, kind of racist or something when they read the script. And there's a lot of moments in that film, I think, that are very racist is probably going too far, but like, I don't think they would fly in a modern film. Like, you know, when you're portraying an entire race as being short or unable to be translated, you know, I don't know. It just, to me, it seems a little bit condescending in some ways.
Hey, lip my stocking.
Hey, lip them, lip them. What? Yeah.
Lip them, like this. Lip them.
Rip them?
Lip, yes.
You want me to rip your stockings?
Yes, rip my stockings, please.
Rip your stockings?
Yes,
you want
please,
me to rip your stockings?
Please, so, please.
All right, I'm going to rip your stockings.
Yes.
And you tell Mr.
Yes.
Kazoo, you know, sure. We had a blast.
Oh, no, Miss Harris. Oh, my God. Don't touch me.
Of course, the film isn't really about Japan. It's about the alienation of working creatives who are paired together in a difficult situation. Blah, 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 blah. But if you like it, great. I don't. I like the bar at the hotel. Like, not because it's in the movie, because it's actually a good bar where you can get a nice Manhattan mixed for you. Yeah, have you ever been in there?
I have, yeah. I went there to interview Jimmy Wang Yu, the one-armed boxer. He was in Japan.
He was
in town for a screening of Master of the Flying Guillotine.
Oh, God, I love that film.
When we were coming down from the interview, the elevator door opened and out stepped Yasuaki Karada, legendary Japanese karate movie star.
Wow.
And I guess he was going up there to fight with Jimmy Wang Yu. Like, I have very happy associations with that hotel.
You should. You should. And that film, God, The Flying Guillotine, that film and several others, without it, like, the Street Fighter franchise wouldn't exist. Like, for Japanese video game creators, took so much inspiration from those Hong Kong low budget but high, very awesome action-packed films, like the, you know, Flying Guillotine. One-armed Master versus the Flying Guillotine?
One-armed Boxer.
Boxer, excuse me. Not to be confused with Crippled Masters.
Which is another great movie. No, he's a boxer. He's like Jake Paul, Matt.
Yes, definitely. No, Paul Logan? I can't even keep up with my influencers anymore. I don't even know. Is he like M. Bison? Is that what you're saying?
Okay, so fun fact, when they brought Jimmy Wang Yu to Tokyo to, you know, give interviews and do a screening of Master of the Flying Guillotine in Kabukicho, there apparently had to be all kinds of, like, underworld deals made because Jimmy Wang Yu was a, quote, real good fella, if you know what I mean.
Was he a made man?
They were basically showing his movie in Yakuza turf, and he was kind of coming from, like, a different set, if you know what I mean.
I see. So it's like showing your Bloods movie in Crips-like territory? Is it that kind of thing?
It sounded like there was something shady going on, Matt. But wow. That takes us to our next story, our final story of the show here, Matt.
Okay.
Japan's Yakuza wants powerful organized crime fighters who would help organize screenings of Master of the Flying Guillotine in Japan are reduced to selling Pokemon cards.
Yakuza member arrested for stealing Pokemon cards as Japan's criminal underworld declines. Even for the Yakuza, every penny counts. On April 26th, Tokyo Metropolitan Police arrested Keita Saito, a kanbu, or executive, of the Takanagawa Gang, a branch of the Sumiyoshikai, Japan's second most powerful organized crime syndicate. The man is said to have stolen 252,000 yen, about US$1,500 worth of goods. The loot included 25 Pokemon cards, popular trading cards based on the Pokemon video games launched by Nintendo in 1996.
Wow, life imitates art. This is exactly like a scene from The Sopranos where Christopher wants to quote unquote jack a load of Pokemon cards. Do you remember that? It's on YouTube. Find it, run it. It's awesome. Pokemans!
Oh, tonight, puss, I got something hard edge.
What?
Pokemon cards. Me and Tommy Mac are taking down a truckload.
I just heard about they're gonna jack a load of these Pokemon cards.
This was world news, Matt. Some guy had like 25 Pokemon cards, and suddenly, like, the Yakuza are like a joke. They're no longer the terrifying figures of the underworld, all missing pinkies and tattoos.
Doom for defaming the good name of the club. You're really going to get in trouble here for making fun of the Yakuza being purveyors of Pokemon cards. I don't think this is a trend. I think this is just some random isolated incident that just made it into the newspapers.
That's not what it says, Matt. It says Le Monde newspaper from France says this is the decline. This shows the decline. Yes.
It's a pattern. It's a pattern. How much was the heist for again? How much are those cards worth?
$1,500.
Wow. Heist of the $1,500. Wow. Is that all it takes to get into Le Monde these days? There's definitely single Pokemon cards worth more than that. You know, how the mighty have fallen, Patrick. Well, this has been a roller coaster of an episode, from the death of a legendary filmmaker to
the death of a Shakey's, Matt, arguably even more tragic.
Much more tragic. The discovery of seminal toothbrushing animation, organized crime falling from its battles without honor and humanity. Now they're really living up to that name by stealing Pokemon cards out of the...
Is that like cards without humanity? Is that what it's called?
It is. This is cards. So is it true the next Battles Without Honor and Humanity is all about a Pokemon's heist? I hope so. in the mean streets of Osaka. It could happen. It could happen to you.
Viggo Mortensen in American Pokemon Yakuza. Remember that movie?
You haven't seen this movie in the theaters or on video. It's an HBO world premiere. Yakuza, the Japanese crime family. They have their own customs. And a code of honor, which excludes outsiders.
A true American.
But when one man infiltrates their inner circle...
Never had anybody in this deep before.
He's double-crossed by the FBI and caught in the middle of a mob war.
They're not innocent people, the Yakuza.
American Yakuza, an HBO world premiere, Thursday night at 9.
Well, Matt, that about wraps it up for episode 92 of the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. Man, we ain't getting any younger. But we want to thank everyone for listening to our show, supporting our show, spreading the word, telling people to listen to our show if you like it, and that sort of thing.
Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. I'm going to be watching Dirty Duck until then. This will be on the final exam, so you need to be too. Catch you next time.
See you next time. Bye.
Shakey's wild.